Right here. Okay, so welcome Jaden, Piero Kaufman.
So I'm Jaden. I'm the principal engineer on the National Deep Inference Fabric. And then, so what is the NDIF? So it's a set of tools and hardware enabling people to do research on very large neural networks. And why are we specifically doing this? It's because probably doing research on the models that actually affect our lives is important, like, ChatGPT and Claude. And then there's a nice figure here from my paper on the right showing the research people are doing is not on the largest model. So like here are all these publications on the right-hand side in these like blue bubbles, marking different pieces of research done on open source models. And then on the right, the exponential kind of increase of model size over time, whether it be closed or public. Yeah, and there's not really any incentive for large companies to be doing this work. So kind of we have to. Whether they believe it's not useful because, as long as you get inputs and outputs and they work, that's fine. Or that you can't do it, right? It's a black box, it's just numbers flying through the model. I'm sure this lab obviously doesn't agree with that. So where are we now? So like one of the biggest things that's happened recently is, right, we're finally on Delta. I'm pretty sure even if
Oh,
you
you have to explain all these things. What is
what's a
Delta?
delta? Right. I was gonna say, like, even if you're in this lab and you have nothing, no idea about NDIF, you probably have heard the word Delta and Michael complaining about it or I complaining about it. So that's our partner who is at NCSA, and they have a large GPU cluster that they just built. We were originally going to get this grant for about double the money, and the other half of the money would have went to hardware, but they said, work with our partners who we just funded for $10 million in hardware because, you guys are software guys. We give you the money for hardware.
So you started somewhere else, local or something?
Like oh, where our machines were? Yeah, we had some machines here at Northeastern. They were actually pretty nice machines. They were like 8x A100s, which could fit one of the models that we're trying to run. But if you want to expand, right, we need a whole cluster. And so, the primary model we're working with, right, is 405B. There is research on 70B and 8B, but like 405B is this huge model where there really isn't any research, and it's like kind of the standard for like the largest open source model. And so we're running that with our pilot program right now, where we had people submit applications to do research on Llama 405B. We selected about 10 of them to start, and they've kind of been our like guinea pigs of like seeing how they're using the system, all the different problems that they had running things, and the different use cases, right? Some people want to do training, some people want to just get do inference, and kind of tailoring our future service based on that. And we're already looking to like add more people. I think now we're go up to like 30 or 50. So we're finally learning about like how our system behaves with some observability, meaning that just like we can see the metrics of how the system is processing people's requests, how long requests are taking, which models are being requested, which is important, but when we're just kind of looking to get off the ground really fast, we didn't really have time to do that. But now that we're here, that's kind of going to guide us forward and how we change the system. And then we're going to be releasing Insight 0.4 at the end of the month. And that kind of adds a lot of different features that people will be able to do some of the experiments that they want to do via their proposals.
Is that the name of your software?
Yes,
The
so
name.
that's the Python library that people use to interact with NDIF.
Okay, got
It's a
it.
custom API format. You can't really interact with NDIF just over HTTP directly without using Insight. I'm going to visually just kind of go through the entire architecture of the system. I'm not sure what speed I should do this at, but we'll see as we go. So I'm going to be building up to this figure by piece by piece, and so this is kind of how NDIF works at a global level. Just like for the legend real quick, anything you see like in blue, that's like a single Docker container, so it's kind of like one service, and all these like services are different microservices that interact in order to fulfill people's requests. To start, right, like I said, so Insight is how people interact with NDIF. It takes people's experiments and represents them as an intervention graph, which I'll talk about in a second. And there are kind of two components to the NDIF backend that processes people's requests. There's the OpenStack kind of front end, which is all the services that don't have to do with executing people's requests on GPUs. So it's like, for receiving requests, storing things in a database, and then responding to you with updates. And that's on the Massachusetts Green High Performance Computing Cluster, which is in Western Massachusetts. And then the other half is on Delta AI, which is the cluster from NCSA with all the GPUs. Yeah. So like I said before, Insight takes experiment code. You want to do some experiment on a large model. You want to see how some part of the model is behaving, or you want to say inject some of your own logic to like influence it and see what changes. That's represented by a computation graph, which we call the intervention graph. And so that's what Insight generates that is representing the entire experiment to be sent to the server.
I assume that those are very different for each model because the architecture of each model is potentially quite different.
Yeah, so like one thing will be just like the name, right? So like one model will have like the name of like an MLP layer be like MLP, or some will spell it completely. But most of the transformer architecture are actually pretty similar. And so like some of the experiments you might want to do on them are actually very similar. You just want to like get some values and then run a few functions on it. And to do that over different models, all you'd have to do is like change like this string saying which part of the model you want to experiment on.
Got it.
Yep. Eventually we're looking to expand to like very different types of models, but right now they're pretty all similar. Yep. So first we need to serialize the intervention graph, meaning we just need to turn this into a format that we can send over the wire. So I don't know if you've used Python or like pickling, but you can pretty much convert any object into bytes and then send that over the wire to generate it on the other end. But Pickle is really known for its insecurity. So like,
Yes, I was hoping you weren't going to say
right,
that
I'm
was
not
your
using
choice.
because you pretty much can't prevent it from running arbitrary code. So we have a custom serialization format where we define like a list of certain operators you can use and certain data types, which even with just limited set we have, like pretty much expand to like all the experiments we've seen so far. Tensors, lists, dictionaries, and then all the torch operations and all of, like the basic adding and subtracting operators.
And you didn't use standard JSON or XML or
Yes, so it's a custom JSON
okay.
format. Yes. Right. And then at the very end, so this intervention graph represents all the things you want to do in a computation graph. And as you're executing your interventions, right, each one of these nodes, these little circles, represents like an operation, and kind of the center of the nodes represents like the value that results from their execution. And so in Insight, you have an operation called saving, which is you essentially saying like after execution, I want these values back to me. And so when you save certain nodes, right, at the very end of execution, some nodes will still be filled in, but normally they'd be garbage collected because you don't need them anymore for memory. And so what happens at the very end, right, is you take all those saved values and you inject it into your local version of the intervention graph. And so now you have like a completed local intervention graph when the entire thing was actually executed on our servers. Yep. So the first part of the front end is the API, right? That's the gateway in actually interacting programmatically with the NDIS system. That uses FastAPI, which is a very common Python library to do HTTP servers. And there are four endpoints of note here to actually interact with NDIF. So of course the request one is where the actual serialized intervention graphs are sent to. And that's where some other things happen, like validating your API keys, and then routing the request to the backend where it actually gets executed. A status endpoint, which just tells you what's currently up, and that's what you hit when you go to the insight.net/status to show you all the models and the current configurations.
I'm sorry, that status of the system as a whole, not of your particular request.
Right now, there isn't a lot of observability for like users to see their own requests as they're going through the system, other than like specific updates that they get indirectly.
Is the request API, is that fire and forget? You don't, that is, you get back a response saying, I got your request,
Exactly.
and
Yes.
everything else happens after that.
Yes. So it does not wait for like the whole thing to be done before returning to you that, hey, we just got it. That's all it's saying. I'll skip that one. The request endpoint just tells you we got it, right? And then so once you've known that your job is completed, you have to go back to the server and kind of ask for the response. And then that will return to you all the values that you've saved, like I previously told you about, streamed back to you as pickled bytes, because we don't really care about you being concerned with our arbitrary code execution, but we're concerned with you sending to us. So we send you a pickled response of like anything that was saved during execution. And so how do you actually receive updates about where your job is in the process is you have a WebSocket connection with the server at all times. So that's kind of a live connection that you have on your local machine with the back end. And so if you use Insight, right, you'll get some updates saying we received your job's been approved, your job's running, and your job's completed. And so that's all happening through the WebSocket server.
Can I ask about the result being pickled?
Yes.
If I remember correctly, which I may not, there have been some issues with like pickle format changing or pickle format being effectively different if it's a big endian versus a little endian machine, that sort of thing. Is that something you've
Well, definitely, like, so if your Python, even like minor versions are different sometimes, the pickle format will be different and it won't work. So you will have to like conform to like the pickled version of what we had on the server when we originally pickled it.
Do you have any plan to change to JSON or something so that it's stable so
Yeah,
we can save
so
it?
we could convert the same saved objects to our custom format, right, and send it, but that would like again limit the things that we're sending back. So we're obviously we're limiting things that you can send us, but ideally we wouldn't limit things people can retrieve from the actual execution of the model, because that might be like some object called like GPT-2 output, which is some custom object that only exists for this one model.
Okay. And is definitely in some Python format or something already.
Yeah, right. It's just some Python object. So if we wanted to add our format, we'd have to like have a specific like here's GPT-2 output, here's Llama output, here's a bunch of like thousands of different things. Right. Yep. And then so to actually communicate, because we have a bunch of different WebSocket servers, the one that receives your connection has to be the one that responds to you. And so to do that kind of intercommunication, there's a message broker service which runs Redis. There's a layer in front of the API. So before you actually request or any HTTP request gets sent to the server, it goes through Caddy, which is just this service that we use for a few reasons, just to reverse proxy your ndif.dev URL to send the request to our local port on the server. And then this also does rate limiting too. So you can only send like say two requests a minute to the server. And so there are actually a bunch of different copies of the API running at all times to like consume different requests, but every run 12. But we'll probably want to increase that as we get more users. So we have an object storage service, which just runs MinIO, which is an open source object storage application, which just runs the same protocol as like an Amazon S3 bucket. We just run it ourselves. And so this is where actually all the responses are ended up being stored, and that's what's retrieved when you hit the result endpoint. Your API keys are stored in Google's Firebase, and so that's what's used to validate your API key on the request endpoint. And then so here is kind of our observability stack, so how we kind of know about how the system is working. We have some aggregator service, which is Prometheus, which is a very common metrics aggregator that people use, and that's why we kind of use it because it's popular, which takes in logs from the API and the back end to see how people's requests take during the system, like how long they take at a certain stage, or how much GPU memory your request is taking. That gets sent to the aggregator. And then we have a dashboard, which is Grafana, another popular one. And so we can go right now to grafana.ndif.us, and we can see the different requests coming through the system and their different properties, and maybe what different bottlenecks in the system are taking too long. Okay, so the back end uses this Python library called Ray, and Ray is a library to kind of build microservice architectures that are kind of auto-scaled to your needs, meaning that you get to define a piece of code, you get to define what type of resources that code needs, say like this needs to three GPUs and two CPUs. And then you run a Ray node application on all of your different machines. So I have a machine over here which has no GPUs, and I have another machine over here which has four. I say to Ray, I want to run my application one, and it knows it takes three GPUs, and three GPUs are free, so it knows what machine to put it on. And so that's kind of Ray kind of handles all this auto scaling for us, which is nice. It's pretty synonymous with Kubernetes if you've used that.
Is it built? Is that what Delta is providing, or is that a separate thing?
That's Delta's not providing this. We're using it.
Oh.
And then Delta's providing us the cluster, which we run all the Ray nodes on.
Okay.
Yes. So each of these light blue boxes are these different deployments. And deployments are exactly the thing I just said, where they're pieces of software we want to run somewhere on the cluster. And so the only one we specified array we want to run is the controller. And the controller's job is essentially to build all the other deployments that we want with a very specific type of configuration. So on the right is a very simple configuration of what like you might want to run the entire service on, which is just saying we would like to run Llama 70 billion, and that's it. So Llama 70 billion requires one GPU, and we want one copy of it for the number of replicas. And so the controller ingests that and uses Ray to auto-serve that to any part of the system that can handle a one GPU model. And one of the other services that it creates is the request service, which is lightweight, requires no GPUs, and that's the actual service that ingests the request to then route it to the correct model. So right now, it's really all this service is doing. It's just taking your request, looking at the model you're asking for, and then sending it to the right deployment running the model. But in the future, we imagine that it'll do some more analysis on like the priority of your request. So like you're a special user who you know sent thousands of requests a day. Maybe you get like put back in the queue so somebody else can run the request. Or your request is really big, it might take a few hours. Maybe we should let in some other requests that take just a few minutes first. So that might happen there in the future. And then, of course, the model deployment itself, and that's the thing that actually loads and runs the PyTorch model. So in this case, 70B, on initialization, it loads the model, and then it, just like the request service, right, maintains a WebSocket connection to the server, which then maintains a connection to your local client. So that's why, like, when a request makes it to the model and it knows that it's started running or it's been completed, right, it sends that response over the WebSocket connection with the server to then tell you, the user, hey, here's where you are during your job's processing.
Question. In the example you gave for like how Ray does all this distributed work, like you said it like, oh, this model needs, you know, one GPU or three GPUs. But does that distribution happen on the basis of just like an estimate of how much VRAM it's actually going to use, or is it like a hard coded like a Llama 70B is typically
So
like
yeah, so I mean we hard code it essentially in that service config file is that we're saying like one GPU. You can also specify custom resources, and I have it so it also each node tells you how much VRAM it has. So you could also do it based on the VRAM. But in our case, right, all the GPUs are the same size. So we're just doing like, oh, we already know this takes one GPU.
because the thing I'm imagining is like, well, what if somebody's experiment like requires a lot of gradients, which would be like would explode the amount that it needs.
So right now we kind of just use like a 15% just heuristic of saying like we would like 15% of the GPU to be free for people's requests. But I guess probably in the future there might be like maybe one, they do two deployments of the same model, one with more VRAM free, one with less, and depending on your request, right, it sends it to the right one.
Yeah,
That might be
it
nice.
seems a little tricky to tell, but I guess as long as there's enough padding, it would be
Right.
better.
Like
Yeah.
there's a whole like probably multi-year work stream of like analyzing people's intervention graphs before they come to the server and determining some like heuristics based on that how what to do. So once your request and the intervention graph makes it to the model deployment, right, that's when we finally deserialize it and turn it back into the intervention graph. And then we just use Insight like you would locally on your local machine to just execute the model with the intervention graph. And then like I said before, after executing your computation graph, the intervention graph, some of the nodes will still be filled in, which means you must have saved them because otherwise they would have been garbage collected. And it is those values that are then pickled and then sent to the object store. And then at that point, right, a final WebSocket response is sent to you saying, hey, your job's been completed. Please come back to the server with your request ID to get the results. And that's how it then gets injected locally. And like I was saying, there can be multiple replicas of the same model, and those are all round robin consuming from a queue where they all process requests one at a time. So this is a cluster of nodes, and of course, we're not just running one machine. The current configuration uses five different machines, each running four Gracehopper GPUs. And so we can run a Ray node on each one of those. And then so Ray obviously knows to serve our models to the correct node, which has enough GPU capacity. So let's talk about a different type of model, a distributed model. And so, we have some pretty big machines here, right? Four 90 gigabyte each Gracehopper GPUs on each of these nodes. But even that isn't enough to run 405B on half precision. So we'll have to run this model on multiple machines at a time. And so to do that, we're going to distribute parts of the model onto each GPU and then communicate onto each node and then communicate between them in order to process people's forward passes.
What does half precision mean in this case?
So representing the parameters of the model, not as float 64 or float 32, but as float 16.
60.
Yes. Right. So just like with the other model deployments, specifying that you want a distributed model starts up a distributed model deployment, and then its job is to kind of do all the other work to build its kind of own like distributed subcluster. So it is the thing that spawns the other shards, also running a piece of the model. So shard zero creates the other shards, depending on how many machines we want to split it over. So that is again like a hard-coded value. So we say like we want to split this model over 16 different GPUs. We don't really care, how many different machines they're on or how many different nodes. We just care like 16 GPUs somewhere.
But the controller or Ray had to know in order to find available free machines.
Right. So like to even like start up this model shard zero deployment, we had to have 16 GPUs free somewhere
Okay.
in the system. Yep. Right. Right. So after the shard zero comes up, sees that it needs 15 other deployments, tells 15 deployments to go start up somewhere in the system. Each one of those deployments is going to load a single 1/16th slice of the entire model. So that means like at every single matrix, right? So MLPs and attention, only 1/16th of the rows and or columns will actually be filled in. And then so it's that shard's responsibility for executing that part of the matrix. And then so to actually do all these distributed communications, which I'll talk about, right? There's NCCL, which is a protocol for doing communications between GPUs distributedly, that runs on the model shard zero, and then all the different shards are communicating over this NCCL protocol to do the processing. And so, there's like tons of these distributed operations that have to happen, right? So, like, if you've broken up one of your Q or K or V matrices into 16 chunks, before and after every single time you process 1/16th of these, right? You need the values of the entire tensor to even go to the next layer or the next matrix. So, after processing just the Q, K, or V, you need to actually then go back to all the different machines, collect the full tensors, and then bring them back, which is, a pretty costly operation, but GPU memory wise, right? Just one person's forward pass, like hidden states, is not nearly as big as like all of the parameters in the system.
Is there any special networking hardware associated with that so that it's not on the same network as all the other traffic, or
No.
no?
Yeah. At some point we need to work with Delta to figure out their whole like setup and like because they've kind of build their setup as like being for distributed training. So I'd like to think that they have some special way of doing things, but
We don't know.
we don't know yet.
I recall NVIDIA having something special hardware for networking. I don't remember what it's called.
Yeah, so these GPUs on the cluster are special in that they're Grace Hopper GPUs, which means a couple things is their CPU and GPU memory are in the same NUMA domain. And that has complications for reasons I'll talk about later. And then also, apparently, it's supposed to be more of a direct connection from the GPUs to the network cards. So there's less transfer of data. But so far, it seems things are slower. So I don't know.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, the GPUs have their own network cards. Yeah.
Right. And so, yeah, shard zero that does all the other stuff, right? It's the thing that sends the data to the results object store, communicates with you about the different statuses. The other shards don't do that. And then, of course, shards can be in other workers, so you can have multiple nodes talking to each other over multiple GPUs processing events. Yeah. So now that like kind of
Okay, so pause for a moment.
hold on.
Okay.
Yeah, can you
Yeah,
go back for
yeah.
the?
That was a lot of pieces.
Right.
So nice pause for
Ask
questions.
questions.
I've asked questions.
You want to go back? Okay.
I've got mine in. Yeah.
Do you have several instances of Llama 405D, or like, why is there these little
You could have several instances of
okay.
it. So anything like with those little like copies of the part and the figure is like you could in theory parallelize it over multiple things. Yes.
And what was the deal between having multiple worker groups for one big distributed model? Like you have, so you have some shards in one worker, and I guess you could have other shards in another worker. Is that the
Exactly.
idea? Okay.
Yeah.
And was Ray the one that's doing like implicitly it's got a job queue or something like that? It's
Yes, yeah. So when you like you submit something to a deployment via Ray, it's putting down a queue, and then all the replicas of a deployment are consuming from that queue.
So is there a reason that like the Llama 70B isn't in its own worker? Or like the head is
So
their worker itself?
the head does some special stuff, right? The control of the requests, but below that, right, it's kind of just another worker. So
I
it
see.
itself can be run on a machine with GPUs, and so it itself can serve models from it.
So the only difference between the head and the worker is this the controller.
Exactly, the extra deployments
Yeah.
controller on the requests.
And so worker here and head just mean a machine that's available in your cluster,
Yes.
right? Yeah. That managed by Ray.
Yeah. And so just one of them happens to be the head, and I guess a
Okay.
couple extra services on it.
Do you need to think about batching or anything like that when you build a
So we are
system
thinking
like
about it, and
that?
the reasons why, obviously, like, because you can batch requests, but then you have to batch intervention graphs, right? You have to
Right.
say, like, you're
Yeah.
intervening on this slice of the thing, which actually we have working with VLM. Oh, yeah, like I said to you. So if we hosted the VLM version of the model, then we could start thinking about actually how to do batching. Yeah, but in theory. So one other thing that, like, for non-VLM models that kind of confuses the batching stuff is
VLM.
VLLM. It's a popular open source library to do inference on language models. And they've kind of done all the state of the art, nice to have stuff for executing things really fast and batching multiple people's requests together.
They also do distributed.
Yes,
So then it's not NCN anymore.
No, so they use Torch Distributed, which is using Nickel. Yeah.
Okay, they do.
Yeah.
Is there, do they, how, what's the relationship between Ray and VLM?
VLM itself uses Ray to distribute different processes onto the different GPUs on your machine.
I see. So that somehow is like the same as the way that we use Ray. Is that right?
Yeah, they're not using Ray Serve, which is this, like for deploying things on multiple nodes, but like even if you ran VLM on one machine with three GPUs, right, it uses Ray to like spawn three processes, which then each communicate with each other over at Nickel. Yes.
Is VLM and Ray like kind of organized by the same person? I think it's the same like.
That's so I'm, yeah, I'm so I'm so I'm just trying to understand, like, we're using Ray and they use Ray, and is that like, I don't know anything about how to set up Ray. Is that like the same Ray deployment, or is it like a nested deployment
Right.
or
So
something that's
there's the
new?
Ray library, which does this kind of like making processes, communicating between the two. And then there's another layer on top of that called Ray Serve. And that's more for cluster-wide stuff. And that's what we're using to like actually have deployments
Okay.
and for auto scaling and serving and stuff like that.
I see.
But the VLM stuff uses base Ray.
Just the communications.
Yes.
I see.
But like I was saying before, one thing that complicates batching on normal requests, right, is like what if you ask for a different like say temperature parameters, right, for your execution, or you want a different way of tokenization or something. It's like hard to batch those. So I guess for non-VLM requests for batching, I'm thinking just like we'll have one set of like here are the default parameters, and if you're using these, you can get batched. If you want to do a different one, then you can't get batched, you know? Yeah.
So, like, even for this super giant model, you have a big benefit from batching. Sorry for the stupid
Probably.
question.
Yeah, I, you know, I, ideally.
You don't fully utilize the GPUs by just forward passing a single sequence.
You sound like if he were to batch, then we'd be using the GPUs more.
He's asking if that's true or not.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'd argue though that we don't have enough users right now for that to be practical.
Right.
Like the
Yeah.
probability of
Yeah.
two users hitting at the same time right now is pretty low, and then the probability of the thing being batchable is probably also low. So.
And the wait time to wait for people's like requests to be batched together versus the wait time they would, incur by not batching is probably way less.
How long is a typical request? How long does it typically take to process them? Or the range? Are we talking minutes to days or?
Yeah, it depends. Like one forward pass maybe takes like 5 seconds.
Okay.
But like some people's requests will have like a loop right where they do multiple forward passes. And so depending on that, yeah.
What if I do? If I have a, I usually have data sets, right? And I do kind of the same interventions on each data point. Do you batch those?
You could batch
single user.
Yeah, yeah. So just like, you know, you're defining batching things in your local script, right?
Oh, the user
instead accepts the same kind of like
okay.
framework. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Okay.
That's why we have a max timeout of about an hour on the models now, because like we were looking at, you know, the logs and somebody's doing like a data set of like thousands of things looping over and over and over again. We're like, what is going on?
Yeah. And they're all editing it too, so completely block the queue, so no one could actually like request.
Oh, they're saying multiple requests, each one.
Yeah, like you couldn't even see the model was not listed anymore because the thread to like check the status of it was blocked because the
user
was
using
so much.
That's great.
Yeah, and it was for hours and hours and hours and hours. It's crazy.
Yeah. These PhD students, when they want to get something done, they have
let no me mercy, ask again.
No mercy on your system.
Yeah. Yeah.
Somebody mining bitcoins.
Right. Oh, no. Oh, no.
Using lava.
I want somebody to try, and then if they can, I can change things. Yes. Okay. So I have an animation showing the life cycle of a request that goes to the system, so you guys can further understand how things work, right? So on the left, right, you have an idea represented by insight code, which is experiment, which you can convert into an insight intervention graph, right? That gets serialized, turned into this request object, which takes your API key. Yeah, which model you're using, right? And then the session ID, which is like how to respond to you over WebSocket, gets sent to the server. That is then validated that you have a valid API key via Firebase. It becomes a backend request. Then we tell you, hey, we've received your request. That gets sent to the Ray backend via the request deployment. Upon seeing that your model is actually one of the models we're hosting, will then tell you, hey, your job's been approved. Now, let's say you requested Llama 4.5b, well, then the request object will be sent again via Ray to the worker node and deployment that is running 4.5b. We will tell you that your job is running.
So let's say the user has to close their workstation, you know, their laptop or lose right. power. Can they re-establish connection to all that? Did they have to have saved session ID somehow, et cetera?
So you can run your insight request in a non-blocking mode, which just means send the request and then immediately stop. And then the next time you start your script, right, it'll check a local save job ID to find out the current status.
Okay.
And then if it's completed, then it knows to go to the server and grab the response.
Okay.
Yeah. But so if you're running in the default mode, we assume that you'll be like waiting for your requests.
But if you're one of these PhD students who have sent thousands of requests,
right,
not so much.
Exactly. Yeah.
Wait, is there a time limit of how long these responses are saved or something? Because you said like you can kind of get the
second. Right now, no. I mean, they're deleted the second you retrieve them. So if somebody never retrieved them, they would stay there forever. Yeah, we do need, you know, some cron job to then check in for some while. Shard zero then duplicates the request, sends it to all the shards. You know, so like deserialization happens on all of the different shards, not just on shard zero. We deserialize your request back to an intervention graph. Then we start executing the intervention graph with the model. So that'll do the nickel communication between the different parameters the model is execute. And that not only that is there's a layer on top of insight for distributed models, right? So if you say get the output of a query block in your model, and that happens to be a distributed tensor, there's a layer in between that and the intervention graph on the distributed model that says, I'm going to check for any distributed tensors and make sure I actually recollect them into the full tensor. So anything that enters the intervention graph is made sure to be a full tensor. So we don't have to worry about like, you know, only intervening on certain slices or something. It, you know, brings the complexity way down.
Does that mean that for those things where you need to merge the intervention graphs just being executed on shard zero? Or do you
They're executed on all shards,
Oh,
right?
so you merge everything on all shards and it's redundantly done.
Yes, yeah. I mean, well, most of the time it isn't redundantly done, right? Because all shards will need the full tensor. Right.
I see. But
But
if
like in
somebody
theory, you could like,
but if
yeah.
somebody like writes, I'm just trying to think of something w weird. Like if somebody like writes a random number or like writes the current time or something like that into the tensor, then there might be inconsistency, like the
Yes.
different shards might
Yes.
get different random
If you're doing
numbers.
that, then yes.
Okay, just is
No random
okay.
numbers.
Okay. So it's a little bit of a leaky abstraction, just something to be aware of.
Yeah, I don't even know
Mm.
how do you solve for that.
Well, if you were to do the work only on the charge zero,
Right.
could you do the work only on charge zero? Is there any reason you couldn't, given that everything's being brought together there?
Well, so like operations need to happen on all the different machines,
It
right?
would
So
need to be
like,
distributed back out to the
right, I need to
machines,
be
yeah.
sure to back out. But like, yeah, but distributing, like, how do we know to distribute, like, let's say you're just using like the random library in Python, right? How do we know like that needs to be distributed to all the different machines?
I think I'm missing something then, because it sounds like at each, everything that gets distributed then has to be brought back. If it's been sharded, then you have to. Every other shard will eventually need to know the output values from, shard one. And that all goes through shard zero. So that sounds like you could do your interventions all, after everything's been calculated, find out, record what the output value was from all the even number shards. Well, that could all happen on shard zero rather than spread out. Am I missing? So what am I missing?
So like you're saying like the output values themselves, but like let's say you have like an in-place operation that you do on a tensor, that would have to happen all the different shards, right? Because there's no way for us, I guess like we could,
Like if you were to cut out a node or I mean a weight or
yeah, or like just
something.
index an array and change it to something else.
Okay. Got it. So interventions as opposed to recording. So interventions have to happen where, distributed.
Right. So we could differentiate between like, in-place operations, which we might want to do anyway for other reasons, and then only do work on all the machines if we think that you're doing an in-place operation that affects like sensors in place. Yeah.
Okay. Got it. Thank you.
Yep. And then after execution, right, you have a partially filled in intervention graph where a few of the nodes have been saved, represented by the green circles. Which is then sent to the object storage. Then you are informed that your job is completed. And then you go back to the server and say, please give me the response or the result. And then now that results in a completed intervention graph on your local machine as if you were to execute it locally yourself. And before I move on, any questions about this?
Yeah, I'd be inclined to have at least a some amount of grace period between reading the result and it being deleted, because you don't know whether the just because you wrote the bytes to the network doesn't mean they made it to the other end.
For sure. Yeah, and so much has been learned over the past year, right? Just going from me working on this to a team of now like Michael and Adam, and then all the kind of the PIs, the professors coming in and starting to do more things. So much has changed. One of the biggest things that I guess I didn't expect, although I didn't really have any preconceptions about how long it would take to move our system onto Delta, I kind of just thought, oh, it's more GPU machines, right? We'll just put it on there and everything will be fine. But it's been quite difficult to have to like go through another entity and not have, sudo access to all their machines and right. So kind of it's a people problem really to like work with them to communicate what's important to us and kind of the severity of we need this done now or right. And then like I was saying with the new technology, so the Grace Hopper machines have had quite many problems in getting our system to run on them. So one problem is, right, because they share a NUMA domain, just like you would, your machine normally caches things. Let's say if you just copy a file from one spot to another, your machine would normally cache that. Well, on Grasshopper machines, because it thinks the GPU memory is part of the CPU memory, it's just going to use GPU memory to copy something. So you'll copy a file and you realize, well, your VRAM is totally filled up. And so to get around that, we have to kind of do a bunch of like hacky stuff in terms of like before we copy anything, we have to run a program to just make a big tensor, fill up the GPUs, don't let you use it for caching.
Is that really a Linux shortcoming? I assume this is running on Linux. That it doesn't have the knowledge baked into it that this memory space that looks like it might be, uniform is really not, and therefore, some portion should be, used for the I can't remember what they call the page cache portion, but
It sees it all as one thing.
yeah.
And at least from Delta's perspective, they're saying like, oh, well, that's just kind of how it is, and there's not really a way around that. So
That is to say they don't care about the problem. It's not hurting them.
Well, and then they'll say like, oh, NVIDIA had these type of problems for the past two decades, but then they're the ones who invested like how many millions of dollars in NVIDIA chips. So I don't know. Another thing that's really important is like having a consistent environment. So like, to really care about observability or security, or to like get a good process of how to deploy your system, those are all kind of hard things to do when your system's constantly changing and composed of like a bunch of different types of deployments. So before we were on Delta, right, we were on some of our machines, we were on some of the Nagoya machine, we were on some of the machines at MGPCC, we were on some of Arjun's machines at his lab, all distributed. Is like one cluster with like different types of operating systems and different like other people using the machines at the same time for like their own experiments, and that introduced tons of different weird errors, which I hoped would go away on Delta, and it seems that they have, so that's good. But yeah, I guess the main takeaway here is that like to really get like the good process stuff going in terms of like having a consistent deployment and understanding how your system behaves, you need a consistent environment over multiple months, ideally, to understand that. One thing that's been annoying is maintaining multiple versions of Insight with NDIF, right? So, for all NDIF releases, if they coincide, with a similar time with an Insight release, we kind of have two versions of
I'm
both
sorry,
being
what was
developed.
the first one? Insight and
And NDIF. So the
okay,
NDIF
I see.
code, the things I show
Got it.
here, and then the Insight library. So right now, right, there's an 0.4 branch of NDIF and an 0.4 branch of Insight, and they both have like kind of different ways the same type of update needs to happen.
Yeah, this is where I would definitely recommend not using pickles. So, because in fact, that my experience is it's really useful to be able to support multiple versions because you want to do incremental rollouts, for example, to make sure that things are not going bad,
And the same with Insight version too, because
right.
the Insight version might change and change how it's serialized, and keeping
Right.
that consistency is probably important. Another thing is just kind of balancing between going fast and then stopping and then thinking about what we're doing now. We just had so many points in the past year where we just had to get something out, right? We needed to get 405B, we needed to get on Delta, we needed to get the pilot program users situated, which doesn't really give you a chance to kind of say like, okay, is our system architected correctly? Should we be focusing on like observability stuff right
But I
now?
think we can answer that. The answer is always no, first, because it was based on what you thought at the time, and now you have new information. You always have regrets. So you have to give yourself a break on that.
Oh, for sure.
It's having spent like 3 years, the last 3 years in that environment, like is the only way to do things, honestly, is just to like do something. And
But then you hear your project manager Smeet in your ear saying how like everything should be 1,000 GitHub tickets and told exactly how long it's going to take for the next 4 years.
No, that also doesn't happen.
I feel like with these things especially, you can't anticipate how you can try to anticipate how people are going to need it, but it's always
Absolutely.
wrong. So.
Another important thing, just from a managerial perspective of like learning how to be a manager, right, is like it's really important to define like if you're bringing on somebody new to the team to like say like, oh, here's your part of the project that you're responsible for. here are the exact kind of like success metrics that you can like look toward, because, you know, without that people can get lost, and that's never good. So yeah, going forward, doing that is probably quite the priority.
No, I'd say it very much depends upon the employee that
right.
you're bringing on, because, and people can be vastly different in whether they need that guidance and yet be very successful contributors to a team. So somebody who doesn't feel comfortable without a very concrete charter could still be a brilliant member of your team, as well as the person who you just point them in the vague direction and
yes.
they will succeed.
Yes.
You know,
I'm the vague direction type of guy, but I guess it's good to have a concrete charter ready to go, you know, regardless of like if you are right. or not, you know.
I mean, so it certainly helps with a new person to have a starter project.
Yes.
That gets their feet wet, and then maybe a starter project after that, you know.
Yeah, because especially if you're on a new project, like all the different things you have to think about and like kind of the explosion of different problems that you think you maybe need to solve when you actually just really need to like get an API key into the dashboard, you know.
Telemetry.
Yeah, telemetry. We need more telemetry. I guess it would have been nice to have that earlier to debug some of the things in the system, but like we were saying before, it's kind of hard to focus on that when you actually just need to get the thing working so people can use it for experiments as fast as possible.
I would say most of the postmortems I was involved with at Google involved add new telemetry.
Yeah.
So,
you know. Very, very, yeah.
Right? So there's always something, oh, I wish we'd known that.
Well, was any of the postmortems like, oh, we wish we had like delayed development a little bit to work on telemetry, or was like, we wish we could have done both?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's, I was going to ask you, you know, what your bigger challenges are, which you're not showing us. And I was going to put the caveat besides needing more time, because you always need more time. We always wish we had had more time for features and for making it run better.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can't think of a time when that wasn't the case.
Yeah. Especially right now, we're like really trying to get our foot in the door, right? You know, like make NDIF necessary as fast as possible.
Yeah. You want people to be complaining that because they need the feature.
Yes.
Yeah, right.
So do you have people complaining?
Oh, yeah. I mean, where's the kill? Yes. For sure.
But you don't want them to say, I didn't get my PhD because, you know, you don't want them to say
exactly.
they couldn't get there.
We wanted to push for this conference to get the 4 or 5 year results, but like, right. you know, it was down over the exact. That's the biggest thing. Yep. So looking forward, you know, where is NDIF? What would we be doing for the next, like, probably, like, 6 months? Michael's been working on, like, having a consistent deployment setup. So, you know, it's not kind of black magic on how to deploy the system. Really doing good, like, site reliability engineer practices to have, like, kind of a turnkey system where, you know, I or Adam or even, you know, David, who may know how the system's architected, can just go on to the system if it's down and press a button and restart it. Metrics collection, like I'm talking about, and there's kind of 3 reasons why we need a lot of metrics. Probably the primary reason is for the NSF. So we need to go back to the NSF and say, because right now we're running on Delta, right? But we only have so many GPU hours that's been allocated to us. And that was kind of a very rough estimate of like, we want to run the system over the next 3 months. Here are some numbers. But next time we go back and ask for hours, we want it to be a kind of more principled and like, well, people are using these models this often. So if we want to continue that service and expand over the next 6 months, here's what we need. And they expect a more principled approach next time. Yes. And then obviously internally, so we understand like how to change the system and, you know, what's going on, where are the bottlenecks in performance. And then, like I was saying before, like for users, right? Like it'd be nice if they could go to a dashboard, see their jobs, see all the results that they have. That would definitely make them feel more comfortable about like sending their experiment off and, you know, who knows where it's going or what's happening to it. Yeah. And then alerting, you know, it'd be nice if we got a notification to our phones saying like system's down, please restart it, instead of kind of waiting for somebody on Discord to go, hey, please restart the system. Yeah. We're going to be like building like a test harness to test all these things, to see load balancing, how the system behaves with different types of insight requests for like looping or, you know, doing streaming back and forth, which is a new feature to insight. And Adam's going to be kind of taking a point on that for the next 6 months. Then once we know metrics and we can test the system, well, then we can tune the performance because, you know, people have been reporting that the new Delta version of the system is slower. We have no idea why. Could it be the GPU communication? Could it be the HTTP communication? We'll have to find out.
Do you have a way to deploy your software like on local hardware the same as if it were on Delta? I mean, effectively
the same, right? Because, you know, on Delta, there's like to communicate between the front end and the back end, we have to set up some like SSH forwarding, which doesn't exist on a local machine, and that might be a big source of slowdown. But in terms of like the base system itself, yes, we have a way, yeah.
There's a whole repository that I'm building for doing that. So you can basically use one repository to deploy in any scenario, essentially, or okay, theory.
Good.
And then, so like one of the ways we've shifted in looking at NDIF is kind of building it around these specific applications. So, you know, once NDIF exists and is usable, right, we want kind of higher level abstractions on top of that for people to use in the classroom, right? So if you want to learn about a model, we want the best way to do that to be you load up this, you know, Logit Lens application, which is some web page, which shows you, for if you don't know what Logit Lens is, it kind of shows you as a language model is processing your prompt, what it's thinking about along the way at the different parts of its brain, essentially. And that's a really good, like, first heuristic on understanding maybe, like, what it's thinking about. Yeah. So getting a lot of those applications up and running and then having them be useful in the classroom is really important at proving NDIF is useful. And then we want to standardize NDIF as, like, a Docker container. So, like, if you yourself wanted to run your own version of NDIF, you could do that, you know, fairly easily on different types of systems on, like, AWS or wherever you'd like to run NDIF.
It's like three different startups now, right?
You're using NDIF?
They are making different variations of NDIF sort of on their own.
Yes. And then, you know, one of them has like express sentiment that they want to help and contribute back. So that'll be nice to like help other people just like add pull requests and stuff.
When I get to the point, OpenAI is asking, can we run NDIF locally?
Well, they have to. They're legally obligated to.
either the state of California has told them they have to do it, or their customers are asking them why don't
we would like to have this. Yeah. We would like warning before Skynet starts, you know, going haywire.
And then just some open questions about like things that I, you know, are pretty far in the future, but I don't really know how to solve. Right. So the Grace Hopper stuff, it's kind of shocking how little Delta knows about the problem, how other people who are using Grace Hopper GPUs know about the problem. I guess the best
way. How much NVIDIA is selling these things.
Right. How much is one chip, you know, like.
They just keep on, every NVIDIA event, they say, buy Grace Hopper. They were just advertising this new $3,000 machine at.
Mini one.
Yeah, that's another Grace Hopper machine. Is it? With this unified memory architecture business. So as soon as you like load a file, you're not going to be able to use the GPU anymore.
Right.
Is the context around there like conversations around Grace Hopper specific? If you're like, oh, if you're doing like training, or is it like just like you should be using Grace Hopper for any machine learning application? I guess. Or?
They just want everybody to use Grace Hopper because they capture more of the margin on Grace Hopper machines because you don't have to buy an Intel chip. It's all NVIDIA all the way through.
True.
And ARM. Right.
Yeah. Well, it's NVIDIA's ARM.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
Like I was saying before, like evaluating the performance bottlenecks, right? So we don't know, you know, how the system's working, what parts of the system do we actually not know anything about in terms of how to run things. So like distributed is a pretty new library that Torch has developed. I imagine that, you know, there's 1,000 different environment variables and stuff like things to tune and things like that. Like I was saying before, the safety of the inside API. So, right, we specify these only, you can use only these objects, only these operators. And in theory, right, you can only do things like look at hidden states and interact with them some way, but maybe you can build the Bitcoin mining with the inside API. I don't know. So probably maybe at some point getting like a fellow to like red team.
Is Turing complete?
I hope not.
Okay.
Yep.
Then you can run language models.
Right.
What are you talking
about? And language models are Turing complete.
Right. Exactly.
So if a language model can do Bitcoin mining, and then is that what you're
saying? That sounds such a waste of.
Maybe they will come up with a more efficient way to produce the next Bitcoin.
Oh, I see. Then you'll be in trouble.
Or like the, what was it, OpenAI system for playing chess, which just changed the internal state to say it won.
All right.
Yeah.
Just change one state to like find the right Bitcoin. Like
yeah, whatever. Well, or just to tell everybody, you know, update your, you know, distributed ledger to say I invent, you know, I have all the Bitcoins.
Yeah. That's second on the list after making the paperclip factory.
Yes, right. Right.
Yep. And then just how to manage our GPU hours better. So if we had infinite hours, right, we'd run all the models in the world all the time. But we want to decide, like, especially if somebody asks for a model that isn't up, at some point we wanted to like automatically add a deployment for your model, have you kind of have exclusive access to it for a few hours. And that will really kind of open
it up. Why exclusive?
I guess in theory you couldn't, but like if you're asking for one model and I guess a bunch of people have other requests comes in and fills it up for like the 2 hours that it's up, I guess that's not really great for your one experiment. Yeah.
So you talked about a 1 hour time limit.
Yes.
Why, let's see, would it be possible to split that request, processing that request up into 10 minute batches or whatever, and then every 10 minutes say, okay,
somebody else can come in
and I'll resume when your time slicing of the...
Something we'd love to do. I thought a little bit about it. In like, you kind of have to like save the current state of the intervention graph.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, one other thing that complicates that is like, let's say you're running the model. It's a Python program, right? It's like running a model halfway through. How do you like resume a Python program essentially? Right. So there might be a ways to maybe not do it at arbitrary points, but at like any point where like you're at an insight node or something,
mm-hmm. Right.
Then you can checkpoint something. Yeah. Yep. And then also some way of like maybe asking the community what models they want offered, right? Yeah. At some point, I like to put a diffusion model up there just to see how it would behave.
Oh, sorry, what?
A diffusion model, so like a text to image generation. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, you have they're pretty small, right? You have the space.
How much
free GPUs do you have at the moment?
None. Yeah,
we're they're all getting used.
Yeah, you know, we plan on adding more nodes, but where they are all being used.
They're all being used in the sense that you have deployments for them.
Yes.
What percentage utilization is there?
Like actual like utilization of the GPU is probably very low, right? Because like only when a request is processing is that the GPU being utilized.
Mm-hmm.
So very low.
Okay. So you could, you know, by time slicing for, you know, models.
How long does it take to bring a large model up on a node?
Yeah, so for the 405B, it takes about an hour and a half.
To bring it up. So you don't want to do that very change for...
Especially for 405B. Yeah, you know, it's kind of like the whole proposition with NDIF is that, like, it's worth it for not every individual user needs to, like, be loading the
model. Right. No, I get that. Yeah.
Yep.
So you want to figure out, you know, what percentage of time do you want to spend on loading, you know, let's say 5% versus using.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's all I had. Any questions about the last few slides?
What are the usual reasons it goes down? You need to restart it.
A lot of the times in the past couple of weeks, it's gone down because Delta forgot to give us more time on the reservation. and then Michael will have to email them late at Sunday night and ask for that again.
They have a bunch of Grasshopper machines.
Yes.
And you're getting not machines, but slices of machines or...
We're getting full machines. We're getting five full machines.
Okay.
But we have to ask for, we want to reserve these ones for like a week or 2 weeks in a row.
Not permanently or for the 3 month period or whatever.
We'd like to do that, but... you know, this all goes through Slurm, so it's like we're trying to balance between like us being a special case and them just being treating us as a normal customer. This is what they kind of want to do. Yeah, that's why, you know, Slurm and the long running job.
Slurm.
Oh, Slurm is a software for allowing many people to submit jobs to a cluster of many nodes. Mm-hmm. So, like a lot of universities will have Slurm clusters where they expose a bunch of GPU machines, and then you'll submit a job saying, I want three machines with as many GPUs, and they'll be put on a queue and auto-serve, like Redis, right? And then so we're going through that system. So like we have to submit a job saying, please load all the different models we have and the different nodes. And the default max reservation time is 2 days. So we have to like ask for special treatment and say, please extend this. And we have to keep asking for that every week.
Very similarly, Borg 1.0. So like a Slim job is like a text file with a big comment at the top of it.
Sounds like you definitely need to get them to have a model for you are a service provider on top of this. And so,
which is not what they've experienced before. It's not like a normal use case.
So, and have they at least acknowledged that's a thing they should be doing?
Yeah. I mean, well, like, we are getting some special treatment in the sense that they are allowing us to do reservations for longer than 2 days.
But it's still
a hassle.
Well, but it sounds like it still fails.
Yes.
Yeah.
If he just forgets, you know, it's a very like human point of failure mode right now.
Got it.
So
you need an auto sender on email every Monday morning. Please extend our reservation for 2 weeks or whatever.
Yes.
I am familiar with this though.
Oh, you are familiar with
this? Yeah, because that was the for doing for running tests of the you know, the cluster software. We would indeed, you know, you get it for 24 hours and you can extend it, but you have to remember to extend it. So if your test was running when you forgot, you know,
just remember to request it.
Yeah.
Let's see. And I didn't get those.
Right. Because I think we needed for a GCE zone region, you know, to do a test of that. You needed, it was maybe 125 services running on a whole bunch of machines and some dedicated, mostly not, but some dedicated. So there's just a limited number of such machines.
Right.
And, you know, 1,000 engineers who all would like to run their tests. Yeah.
Yeah. I hope in a year, once we have a lot of performance numbers, like, oh, the GPUs are being utilized, we're having tons of requests. Mm-hmm. And they say, okay, it's, you know, worth it to give you special treatment. But mm-hmm. if we're not using the GPUs, then, like, I understand their hesitation.
Right.
Yeah.
So how many different models do you have that are getting used on roughly a daily basis?
So 405B right now, you know, gets, like, maybe, like, 10 requests a day.
Okay.
But like Llama 8B and 7DB will get like 500, 600, maybe off from like a few users, probably. But yeah, so people are using the open access ones pretty frequently right now.
Okay.
Yes.
Why do you think 405B is so much? Just because you have it's
limited. Only 10 people can use it. Yeah.
Only 10 people, only 10 of your clients are allowed to use it?
Yes, those are special pilot program users. Yeah. The other ones are totally anybody can use an API key and use.
So like of the 10, is it just Nikhil and...
There's a few other ones, yeah. Some guy in...
Maybe...
In Vermont?
Yeah. Vermont is not on that project, but...
He does have a 405B program application. I forget what he's doing.
Definitely. Yeah. Maybe he did one with the multilingual... But we also have Kevin, right? Like the Fury of Mind experiment. So once Kevin starts, I think it's because he is a grinder. It's also going to be a lot.
Good.
I wonder if, you know, you need to either increase the number of people in your pilot program, because I'm guessing you have some who signed up and aren't using it.
Yes.
Or rescind theirs, or, you know, say, you know, people who use it at least once every 2 weeks get to keep it. And...
Yes. Yeah. So we have expanded, and yes, we have gone back to the first 10 and said, like, did you actually use the system? If not, then there's no reason.
Let's use
it like once a week, just for like one run. You know, you have a paper that uses a bunch of different models and you want to like show, oh, it generalizes maybe or works better on a larger model. Just one request might do that. And it might be an interesting result.
Which makes me think that maybe rather than having a very restrictive pilot program, having a restricted, you know, queries per day, you know, it's like you can have one a day if you're not in the program. Just.
Oh, and then being in the program
maybe gets lifts
your quota.
Right.
I see. So that anybody can try it. And then if they like it, then they can sign up.
That'd be cool.
That's a good idea. How hard is that technologically?
No, it'd be really easy. just adding a few fields to the Firebase.
Okay. That's a good idea.
We had, you talked about having rate limits, and so we on the Google, every server is has a set of API endpoints, HTTP endpoints, and most of them were set so that they have a rate limit of like one query per second for anybody who isn't on the team, so you. And every time I say Google, my phone wakes up, which is problematic at my house. It gets said a fair amount. People on the team can then go and look at the status page or whatever as much as they need in order to manage the system. But somebody who's not on the team and is just trying to figure out what does that server do can just go look.
They can still see.
And they can see, but they can't take us down by, excessive queries.
Makes sense.
For sure.
That's cool.
Yeah. I mean, now that we're at the point where we have, some rate limiting and some timeout, right, one person can't totally take on the system. And that's kind of what we just wanted to get to. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's a good idea.
Questions?
It's fantastic. Congratulations for getting to this point, Jaden.
Yeah. Some sleep.
Okay. Be able to take the whole system end to end and put it on a set of slides.
Right.
So, do you feel like this architecture, do you feel like a year from now, if you were explaining how EndIF works to somebody, that basically the same slide deck?
Yeah. I mean, in the sense that, the abstraction of a computation graph gets executed remotely, I feel like that has to stay the same. A thing that serves models to different GPU machines based on how many resources they need.
Just that's probably existing. Each one of the hops.
Yeah.
We'll still have every one of the hops.
I think it'll just add to it, not necessarily change it. One thing might be, so we use Ray, right, for all this, microservice distributed stuff, which is pretty new. Although it's pretty popular within the AI community, it seems fairly restrictive on how much you can customize it. And then one thing, right, I wanted to see whatever distributed queuing system there is, right, for the different models. I'd like to be able to look into the queue and maybe change things around. But at least from what I've seen so far and my questions asked to the Ray team, they're not exposing that programmatically. Yeah, it's not a priority for them, right? Because people want to use Ray as a mid-level abstraction to just serve some model to classify images in your little company, not necessarily build something like this. So either we might have to get rid of Ray or maybe change Ray or ask them to change Ray or,
Is this a Python system?
Yes.
And all this stuff is pretty much all Python?
Yes.
Okay. That's cool.
I was using Celery before Ray.
Celery? I don't know.
And you kind of build it yourself, right? It's just distributed executing code from a remote machine. So you can kind of build right from Celery if you really wanted to. And maybe we'll go back to that.
See.
Maybe. I have no idea.
Yeah.
But you don't want to invest too much in that if you don't have to.
Right. So
putting up with some other systems' idiosyncrasies is worthwhile if you can focus on the features your users need.
Ideally, we make that decision sooner rather than later before we get too much into the Ray ecosystem. So maybe a job would be to actually figure out what's possible and isn't now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's a whole sub-team. The team that's building Ray, they're mainly around building VLLM and things like this, but they have this whole separate project right? And so, you can imagine getting into a situation where we're in a similar situation where, we're trying to build EndIF, but then we have our own job management system, and it's requires this whole separate team to create a job management system.
Well, perhaps if you're thinking about changing, trying to architect your system so that you use abstractions on top of Ray. So you could change Ray out if you needed, but not, you know, but not have to.
Right, right. You know, Kubernetes would do a similar thing, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting.
Well, cool. Thank you, Jaden.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, appreciate it. How's Morocco? Are you in Morocco already, Adam?
Yeah.